everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and in the studio this week with me is Russ Chianelli, a well-known character on campus and on the radio. And today we've got also a guest from Vanderbilt University. His name is Dr. Timothy Hanuza, and he's going to be talking to us about ancient pigments. You know, how did the ancients get color? What's the implication to the technology we use today? Did they have a similar technology without knowing? That's the interesting question. And the answer, of course, I'll tell you right now, is yes. But before we get to the details, Tim, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Well, thank you, Keith. Thanks for great to be invited.
So before we get on to pigments and your interest in them and history of science and pigments, how do you become a scientist? Because I didn't tell people you are a professor of chemistry at Vanderbilt.
That's
how did
correct.
That journey begin?
Well, childhood. Grew up in the 1960s. This is the space era. I remember making small little model rockets out of cardboard tubes from paper towel dispensers when I was in first grade.
Well, what was the propellant?
Well, they're empty.
You
had little cardboard, you know, cones on it
and
cardboard tubes, and it was.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Iowa,
in
Council Bluffs, Iowa, right. And so I wanted to be an astronaut. Eventually, Grant got too tall and realized that wasn't an option. But for a while, that was the thing to be.
Be an astronaut, yeah.
Not a fireman or something, but an astronaut. And that was what was cool. And so I also collected rocks. That was a big thing. I had a teacher in third grade who actually brought in rocks from things that she had brought in and would talk about how to analyze or characterize different types of rocks. And she'd say, here's limestone. How can you tell it's limestone? Well, you put vinegar on it, it will bubble. And why does it bubble? You know, and there's this reaction that goes on. And I thought that was fascinating. And so it was that, and my parents sort of realized that there was a budding interest here, so they brought me a Gilbert chemistry set for my 8th birthday. And it just sort of kept on from there. So I'm a little bit more, so it seemed almost a straight line progression, I mean, because chemistry just seemed like the thing to be. So my first semester in college, I declared a chemistry major because, like, why else? What else is there? I went to go on to graduate school in chemistry, and it was made it very simple in some ways.
I had a Gilbert chemistry set, too. And the question I have to ask you, did you have any explosions when you were a kid in your chemistry set?
I certainly stunk up my parents' basement with mixing with sulfur and, you know, burning sulfur and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I never had a Gilbert set. I don't even know what it is. But we've heard so many people on this program over the 35 years I've been doing it that talk about these famed chemistry sets, which presumably today would not be possible to purchase.
Oh, no.
It's too dangerous.
This had a alcohol burner, you know, with the wick, and you could, and real chemicals, you know. And so we made different dyes, like Prussian blue, I think, or different types of pigments, and you could do real types
and
of
Prussian
experiments.
Prussian blue contains cyano groups.
Yeah, maybe it wasn't Prussian. It might have been, though. It might have been ferrocyanide.
It sounds familiar. Prussian blue. I remember that. I think that you're right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so the bottom line, it was ordained. Brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have one brother and three sisters, and none of them are in science. So
you were the first one, the trailblazer, and they watched you.
I'm actually the middle child, oldest son, but they just had different interests. One sister's in politics, another one is a minister, another one teaches school children.
Okay.
So they're just all over.
All right. So now I happen to know that you're a professor of chemistry and you're an inorganic chemist. You specialize in all sorts of interesting things associated without carbon, effectively. But we're not going to talk about that today, because the reason you're in the studio with us is because you have this hobby, this interest in, I will simply call them, ancient pigments. So why don't you tell us, first of all, what I am referring to in terms of an ancient pigment? Correct me if I'm wrong. And then how did you get involved in that as a particular hobby, if you like?
Okay, well, so ancient pigments in general are things that were different chemical compounds that were discovered or invented by ancients, anywhere from ancient Egypt to the Romans. Could be pre-Columbian Americans through various serendipity or however, learned that adding certain salts to glass, for example, or certain compounds to fuse certain compounds together would get very permanent solids, often done because they were less expensive than other attributes. So there's a pigment called Egyptian blue that people think was developed as an alternative to lapis lazuli, which was a very expensive stone brought in from Afghanistan. And so in the ancient world, it was extremely expensive, intense blue. And so Egyptian blue was a much cheaper alternative than the imported stuff. And it became widely used both in Egypt, and the Romans knew about it and used it for centuries. And then it was died off.
Okay, so two things here. I've seen illustrations, I think, of Egyptian blue. And I don't quite see the blue. It's sort of got other colors to it, not just blue. Am I wrong?
You can get different shades of blue. It's basically blue, but it can be blue-gray all the way down to a very dark blue. It depends on the heat treatment, for one thing.
So tell us, what is this material? We know.
Well, so Egyptian blue itself is a calcium copper silicate. And it was actually in the late 1900s, its composition was sort of rediscovered, and then crystal structure was determined in the 1950s, I believe. So we know what it is, and we can remake it. You can actually buy it commercially.
But how did the ancients make it? What was the...
So we have a recipe from the Romans. Vitruvius wrote about this, who wrote a book on architecture about 15 BC. And he said you took sand, although it really had to be lime, sort of rich sand. It couldn't be just pure sand. And natron, which was a type of sodium salt, sodium carbonate, that they got from dry lake beds in Egypt. And you mix up with some calcium oxide calx and a source of copper, and then it was poured into small balls and then heated in a furnace, and it would make this blue pigment. And that was used for all sorts of applications in painting. The chief thing, that it was so durable, that was it didn't fade the way that so many plant-derived pigments would. And that was one of the chief selling points for it. And
So the point there would be that this is an inorganic material.
Completely inorganic, right.
And whereas the plant materials are carbon-based, with all of them, the aerial degradation, oxidation, but that wasn't available for this particular material. That's the secret, if you like.
That's the thing, yeah. So you don't have you can degrade it, but under normal sort of conditions, it's remarkable. People found walt being used as a pigment when they excavated Pompeii back in the... So, I mean, this had lasted through a volcano, buried in volcanic ash for, 1,700-1,800 years, and the colors were still there.
How did they apply it? I mean, you talked about the little balls of mixing these materials, and then you grind it up.
Ground up and then applied like a paint.
So then you put it into water? So how do you apply...
I suppose it's dispersed in water. They didn't have organic solvents. So, and it's stable in water, unless the water is boiling, and then it will degrade under hot conditions. But it takes days.
Right.
Here's another question for you. What about Tyrian purple? What was that used for?
Well, okay, so that was the purple dye. That's the Phoenicians got that from a sea snail.
And
so it's an organic dye. It's the dibromo indigo. It's a dibromo indigo. Very small quantities were obtained from thousands of poor sea snails that had to get crushed. And so it became associated with royalty because only the very wealthiest. The Roman senators had only like a stripe of it on their togas because it was so expensive. And to actually have an entire garment dyed with it was just, you have to be the emperor, I mean, to be able to afford it.
It says that my notes about it, because I worked on that, was 10,000 mollusks to make 1 gram.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, it's extraordinarily expensive. And so the expression about being born to the purple, that they supposedly... The birthing room of one of the Byzantine emperors, they had the walls covered in this purple cloth. And so if you were born to the purple, you were born in this room covered with purple cloth, which was just fantastically expensive.
And then came the 19th and 20th century,
and
when Tolkien
and all those sorts of things,
made
and the
these
price.
Things. And so purple became anybody.
Yeah.
Democratization of purple.
Right.
I like it. So we're talking, okay, so you've sort of led us to what some of these ancient pigments are. But how did Tim get so particularly interested in them?
Well, so I've long had an interest in just history in general and took a lot of history courses in college. And one in particular was on the history of science, where we talked about ancient and medieval science and a little bit of the early modern up to like Newton. That was considered about as modern as you want to go. I thought it was fascinating. And when I went on to graduate school at Indiana University, they actually have a department in the history and philosophy of science. And I actually made that my minor, PhD minor, and took three more courses in sort of medieval and modern science, partly because I also had an eye on teaching. I knew I wasn't going to academics, so I thought this would be useful, and partly just of general interest in trying to become have a more sympathetic understanding of the ancients. You know, they weren't just sort of...
Neanderthals.
They were thinking about one of the things that really impressed me was learning about... the alchemists changing lead into gold, you know, and often it's almost portrayed as, well, these people were idiots. What were they thinking? But in fact, you know, this went back to Aristotle and other ancient Greeks about the ideas of metals maturing or growing in the earth. So you went from lead to copper to iron to silver to gold. And the fact if you dug up lead, it's only because you dug it up too early. If you gave it more time, it would mature.
What came after gold? Platinum?
They didn't know about platinum. So platinum is – South American.
That's where the gold standard came in.
Yeah, right. So the alchemists just thought they were speeding up a naturally occurring process. This is what we would call catalysis nowadays. And they did not think they were doing magic or something unnatural. They're working in a totally different conceptual framework. But when you think about that, it's like it makes you a little more sympathetic, at least, to what they're trying to attempt to do. There are a lot of quacks. There are a lot of charlatans, absolutely. But there were people who were seriously trying to make this work, thinking that they had a framework that this was possible in. And then more specifically, the pigments and things came out of at Vanderbilt, we do a lot of – there's a lot of nanoscience you can't avoid, nanotechnology, nano. And just sort of starting, where does nano start? You know, everything has a starting point. You know, and it turns out that many of these ancient pigments, for example, and other things as well, had nano-sized features in them. There are nanoparticles. There are carbon nanotubes that have been found in ancient steel. And many different types of of course, they didn't know what they were dealing with. But, in fact, there were nanoparticles.
But they knew they had to grind it and make it smaller and do things like that.
They often knew that they had different heat treatments for some of the glass, so like ruby glass, where they dissolve gold in it. It's gold nanoparticles that give it the color. And it was discovered that you could get different colors depending upon how long you annealed the glass. And these became – part of it is that you had very highly guarded technical secrets. And so trade secrets. And so sometimes these things would die with the inventor or with – and so things didn't get passed along or they got very distorted transmission. And so you didn't get the real clear story. No one wanted to tell someone else how you were getting this really deep red color.
There was a commercial aspect.
There was a commercial aspect to this.
It's just not Chianelli that introduced the entrepreneurship to pigments.
No. And so, yeah, there was a lot of competition for this because it was a highly prized, especially the colored glasses and ruby glass. And if you had the best on the market, that was, you know, you were sold. So it was just, you know, developing this sort of interest to sort of see where do these things come from and give us a little bit more perspective that there's actually a long history of these things long before the 21st century.
We're going to take a break. You're listening to Science Studio. Our guest this week is Tim Hanusa from the University. No. Our guest this week is Tim Hanusa from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, Tim Hanusa, our guest. And we're talking about some of these ancient pigments and things of this description. And I'd never really given it much thought that these artifacts that we now can see and know about, this was a commercial trade. Right?
In some cases, you're right, yeah.
For example, you called this Egyptian purple, right? I think that was
Egyptian blue. Right.
Right. Presumably it was first made in Egypt?
That's our understanding, around 2500 BC, something
right.
like that.
And can you determine trade routes looking back to see where samples of this have gone? So and are they the same provenance, et cetera?
Yeah, so that's interesting. There's a related pigment, sometimes called Han purple, that is shown up in China. And it's chemically similar, except it uses barium in place of calcium. And because they had local, and so there's a lot of controversy over where the transmission went. Was it because people voyaged from China to Egypt along the Silk Road or something like this, mm-hmm. picked this up and brought it back to China, or was it an independent discovery? And that's not clear. You know, whether it was, did lightning strike twice, two separate places?
But I guess that's interesting. But I mean, I'm also thinking, have you been able to research and find samples of the Egyptian material in other lands of the world? I mean, was there much of a trade, or was the trade mainly localized, I guess?
I think the trade was mainly localized. I mean, certainly in the Mediterranean area there was, between Greece and Rome and Egypt and that sort of, and so it was widely used in that time and for portraiture, for tomb paintings. There are beakers made out of, coated with Egyptian blue. I mean, they have a really durable pigment, and a blue pigment was a valuable thing. And whether, this was discovered independently in China, that's hard to know. I mean, it's sometimes hard to know. So you have an Egyptian blue, sample here and one, 1,000 miles away. Did they come from the same source, or were they separate? I mean, there's the same compound, so it's hard to.
Yes.
Well, one of the things that I found very interesting about this is that perhaps with the Tyrian purples, they ran out of snails in the Mediterranean, and they began to go west. And there's examples that here that, those people had arrived here, the Mayans and the Aztecs and all that, and that snail is down. I found it down in the Gulf of Mexico.
I've heard of that. Yes, it's a slightly different species, I think, than the one in the Mediterranean.
Yeah,
but you can extract, but you
years,
can still get the Dibroma indigo. That's right. That's right. So, sort of, again, an independent discovery. I mean, how it exactly occurred. People talked about, smashing a scale and then watching the juice that came out of the liquid would start to turn color in the sunlight, because the sunlight was important in causing this formation. But it's fairly rare. I mean, it's in a...
I want to take a slight diversion, because I'm now really interested in Russell discovering these creatures down in the oceans down there. Did you go and looking for them, or was this just cut yourself on them?
Yeah, because I just happened to be in the Yucatan down at, someplace. And I was, invited down there for a talk, and I just was rambling around, and I knew the story of the... As a matter of fact, I have a slide with my dog with a purple mouth.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because of, from eating the snails,
This is a wonderful vision.
There I was on the edge, and I'm seeing snails everywhere, and I'm picking them up, and they look exactly the same, and you squeeze them, and they turn purple. So it made me wonder whether they were put there, whether they evolved there, or whether they were dropped there by the Tyrians because they were here.
Well, I mean, that goes back to then the commercialization.
Exactly.
If these materials came from this, what are they called?
Mollusks. It's a murex, I think, is the species.
Murex.
Okay, but I mean, the point that I'm getting at now is, can you just transplant them and grow them? Could we have had this in the south coast of England, for God's sake, right? I mean, that would be where the good trade would be.
Yeah,
not the product,
I don't know their geographical extent. I don't know if they could survive that far north.
But, well, the thing that I always thought about was that the Romans would kill if they found them trading, and then maybe they washed it out. So maybe they could grow them over here. I think it's a theory, because they were here.
Aha.
Both the Tyrians and the snails.
Good. What other interesting pigments are you particularly fond of when you think about all these pigments from ancient times?
Well, so one that's sort of interesting, because it's actually commercially available in store shelves today, although it won't be within a year. It's the pigment that comes using Grecian formula. It's actually based on lead. It's a lead acetate. But this was discovered in the Greco-Roman times. That you could use a lead sort, lead oxide, and a source of base. And it was mixed in with hair, because hair has sulfur in it, sulfide bonds. And so wool or normal hair, and it would eventually break down and form particles of lead sulfide, black lead sulfide. And it was, again, a permanent dye, which was, again, unusual for compared to natural material. So you got that. And you could get different shades depending upon how long you let it go. And now they use lead acetate. So the Grecian formula always had this thing about, you know, no one will know you're using it because you can gradually change your gray to, you know, to brown.
Who discovered? I mean, this Grecian formula is a commercial product, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So do they have a patent on this, or has this been something that has been also known for centuries?
Well, I mean,
people didn't worry in those days.
The general chemistry as they used lead acetate, and maybe they patented that particular use of it. But the fundamental science has been known for millennia.
No, but on hair.
On human hair, it was used, I think, for dyeing for some time, but I don't know exactly when it became commercialized. The point is that the FDA has finally said that it
you can't do it.
You can't do it, and it has to be off the shelf by next year. So buy it now if you really want it.
I mean, it's interesting to think which society was the first society to think that gray hair on an aging gentleman was inappropriate, because the old idea was white hair, gray hair was wisdom.
Oh, yeah?
But something changed, and I'd be interested to know when that change took place and which society. But anyway,
I think hair dyeing goes all the way back.
Yeah, I mean, the Egyptians dyed their hair and using henna for some nights. Really red hair.
Well, that's mainly ladies or no?
No, in Italy, before the Roman Empire, down in the south, and they learned how to do that, what you're talking about. And Aristotle and those people were back in the formulas.
Are you serious?
So
all the way back to the Greeks, they wanted, as they aged, to have darker hair?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I'll tell you one thing about this business of lead. I do a little bit of lead chemistry actually right now and doing a lot of it. There is nowhere in the world that I can find that will sell me any lead compound except lead chloride, lead acetate. Mm. But, you know, the organo-lead compounds that you used to be able to buy, nobody is making them anymore. So it's a nice area to be researching in, because no one can buy the starting materials.
Right.
Okay, so Grecian formula based upon lead, giving black lead acetate, or lead sulfide, rather. Right. What else? What's another favorite pigment?
Well, so it's also based on gold, but it's called purple of Cassius. And it's actually, we know now that it's actually nanoparticles of gold supported on tin oxide. But it was first reported in about 1659 or so by Glauber, who was an alchemist, Glauber's salt. And within 20 years, it was picked up by glass makers who made the ruby glass and that sort of thing. The question over what was this stuff, it was valued because it was a very heat-stable pigment.
Is this the pigment that if you put a light inside the vessel, it looks one color, and if you look from the outside,
nanoparticles are changing the color. That's right. But this was an actual purple pigment that you could make and
you know, some of that, when you say 1600, reminds me that the doctors then were making colloids that they were giving to people at the same time that these things that you're talking about broken out. So there, you know, you're not feeling well, drink this colloid of...
Colloidal gold. And well, you even see that today, the homeopathic that people, they drink silver. And you know, this, because silver is antibacterial and, you know, you can turn blue, I mean, if you drink enough of it. But... And it's interesting because people have the flashes of insights. There was a French encyclopedia in the 1800s that talked about that gold was an extremely divided state in this purple of Cassius, and went through different regions. That gold is naturally purple when it's finally divided. Didn't really have a lot of chemical justification for it, and most chemists, there was Berzelius, who was a very famous Swedish chemist, thought this was nonsense. Because if you make purple of Cassius, it doesn't form an amalgam with mercury, so how can it be gold? He thought it was maybe a gold oxide. It didn't behave like ordinary gold. And it turns out that Michael Faraday, of all things, who's chemist, physicist, everything rolled into one, did light scattering experiments on it, made some gold colloids by reducing gold salts with phosphorus and carbon disulfide, and then was able to show that it would scatter light. You could shine light through it, and you got Tyndall scattering, so that there was actually colloidal. And he said in a published paper that this material was finally divided gold, supported on tin oxide. was published, I think, in 1857 or something, then promptly forgotten. And no one sort of remembered it. And it was Richard Zsigmondy, who was a Nobel laureate, who eventually became a Nobel laureate, who sort of did a lot of work on gold colloids, established that Faraday was right, made the first estimates of particle size, and in his Nobel lecture said, you know, if I'd known about Faraday's work, it would have saved me much unnecessary time on his own. So
Faraday was an interesting fellow.
He was.
He studied initially, I think, with Humphrey Davy.
Humphrey Davy,
who
right.
was the person. He was a scientist, but he was so famous for what he was doing that the coal miners up in the northeast of England went to him and said, "Look, get us a lamp because we need to go down the mountains, but we need light, and obviously we just can't take a flame."
Right.
And he came up with the idea of putting a gauze strip around the flame, and that stopped from explosions because there was no migration of the CO2. Let me back off. So he put in this gauze strip around the naked light, and that did it right there. The gauze strip stopped the migration that could cause explosions.
Right.
Very interesting man.
You know, another thing to talk about is William Perkins.
2 minutes.
More.
Start again. We've just got 2 minutes, though, so you know.
Another person to talk about is William Perkin, MOV.
Oh, yeah.
And he was an 18-year-old chemistry student, and he was made the first aniline dye, which Queen Victoria, and they dyed their dresses with that, but he was not 21, so he couldn't get a patent.
Hmm. And then that's when the Germans took over, after Perkin, because BASF became the big dye people making these for nitrogen bases and stuff. But by MOV... You mean Mauve? M-A-U-V-E.
M-A-U-V-E,
okay. Mauve. I think we've come to the end of the program. Tim, it's been a lot of fun having you here.
My pleasure.
Pigments, everybody likes pretty colors.
Yeah.
All right. And Russell, do you have any closing thought?
No, I think that it's very interesting. We can talk more and lots about Mayan pigments. We didn't talk about that.
Mm. Of course.
I wonder where Mayan pigments come from. Well, perhaps you've heard of that before. We've got to go. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks, Sam Castellano, for putting the program together. And thank you for listening. And we will be back next week with some other little tidbit of science. Adios.